The Financial Survival Network, helping you survive and thrive in the new economy. For a free financial survival toolkit and newsletter, sign up at kerrylutz.com. KerryLutz.com.
1490 WGCH, this is Kerry Lutz. You're listening to the Financial Survival Network. My next guest, Martin Armstrong of Armstrong Economics, formerly Princeton Economics, spent a long time locked away so that you couldn't hear the truth. Martin is an expert in economic cycles and has called numerous crashes and market events that others would think required some prescience or psychic abilities. Martin, how you doing?
Pretty good. How you doing?
I'm doing good, and I'm really happy that you're joining us on the Financial Survival Network. You spent a long time locked away because of you upset some people, you ruffled some feathers, and as my father would have asked me, have you learned anything from the ordeal?
Well, I think that what really surprised me more than anything is just how blatant the corruption has really become. I think that has surprised me more than anything.
Yeah, well, one minute you're on top of the world, the next minute you're locked away. Is that a lesson for the rest of us here in America of what can happen to you when you cross the powers that be?
Well, I think that what you have to understand is that we tend to think we live in a democracy, but in honesty, we really don't. The only people we elect are those down in Congress, and that's it. Everything else, all the bureaucracy, the agencies, you know, SEC, CFTC, you know, they're all appointed. And you really, I think some of the most shocking things, the SEC has its own little court. You don't even have to be a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
It's whoever they want to appoint. I mean, if it's a friend of a friend of a friend, he's now a judge. He has no legal background at all. I mean, stuff like that, just like you look at it and say, what?
Mm-hmm.
You know, so, I mean, there's been a, from that perspective, my eyes were probably opened wider than I had anticipated. But it's a sad state of affairs. I mean, even what you see like going on with in Oakland and New York, you know, with the Occupy Wall Street crowd. I mean, they may not have everything correct. They may not necessarily be able to focus exactly on what the problem is, but they still have a right to protest.
Sure.
You know. And
well,
I think that, you know, that's the sad part. You know, it's I had written last week that sources I had in New York told me they were going to do this. So, you know, that they were going to start getting violent and go after them.
Mm-hmm.
And I just put that out on our website last week. And
I saw it. Yeah.
Sure enough, they do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's just a shame.
Yeah. It
but
is.
There's too many vested. There's too much vested interest, and unfortunately, because the bulk of the country is not really an elected type process, we really have no control over it, and it can be bought and sold to the highest bidder.
Yeah, well, somebody once said the more laws they passed, and then Congress shifts the rulemaking authority and the administrative process from themselves to faceless bureaucrats who are then free to engage in all sorts of travesties. And I think that's where we're at now with every single agency that's administrative, the FTC, the FDA, the FCC. I mean, you name it, every one of those alphabet agencies is a law unto itself. It's judge, jury, and executioner for anything that's in its jurisdiction.
Well, it even gets worse than that in the sense that the judiciary is like a king. I mean, you can't do anything. They're there for life. They can never be removed. And they claim the authority that if Congress passes a law, it's them who says basically what they think it means. And so consequently, they don't even have, you know, when I do speak, I was down in Congress in Capitol Hill this week, and they basically feel that, you know, that they're the ugly stepchild or something. Nobody really pays attention to them. You know, they pass a law, but, you know, the courts say it means something else. And then the president, you know, claims the authority of signing statements and says, well, we're not going to pass, you know, we're not going to enforce that one, or we will enforce this, not that. So our elected process isn't really much of anything anymore. And I think that's the real sad state of affairs. And they get lobbied tremendously, not just by private sector, but, you know, I was in a meeting and a congressman asked me, he said, you know, if you just personally, I don't know what to invest in. Mm-hmm. Should I be buying bonds? Should I be buying this? And I said, well, quite honestly, I said, you know, this is what hedge funds are. I said, I argued in 85 that we should have merged the SEC and CFTC.
Of course, it made total sense.
Because if you obey the laws of the SEC, you go to jail under the CFTC.
Mm-hmm.
So consequently, what people won't realize is that we have all sorts of funds here in this country. We have muni funds and bond funds and stock funds and high growth funds, etc. And everyone's going to be like a used car sales. Each one's going to tell you they got the greatest one, you know, out of the whole lineup. Whereas offshore, a hedge fund manager, you're hiring him to make that decision.
Mm-hmm.
You can't do that domestically because we have too many agencies and they clash with each other, so one person can't run a fund for the individual. So consequently, we, because of our regulation, which is actually over-regulated in the sense that we have too many agencies that compete with each other, so that, you know, basically the average individual has to have the expertise of a top fund manager.
Yeah, good
luck.
Because
he doesn't know what to do, you know, and so if he's going to go talk to each one, they're all going to tell him that they're the best.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where, I mean, we have over-regulation. We had more than 10 agencies regulating the mortgage-backed stuff. Okay, with all of this power, we still have the crash. Not a single one picked up anything. So, you know, when you say, you know, we're over-regulated, people go, oh, no, obviously we weren't because of the crash. That's not the issue. The issue is we just need a single agency that actually does it. You know, you have 10 of them, and all these, and every one of them then has constituencies, lobbyists. I mean, forget the private sector. Each agency then has its own little group down there on Capitol Hill lobbying for their own, you know, for their own pots. So it's a nightmare, an absolute nightmare.
Yeah, I can see that. And reminds me, one time I was in court, and this lawyer was saying, Your Honor, this is what the law is. And the judge interrupts the attorney, young attorney, and says, young man, in my courtroom, I am the law. So that's it's like.
That's exactly it.
Yeah. Yeah. That's it. So
people don't realize that when this country was formed, we had to, in England there, and still are, there was a Chancery Court, and then there was the King's Bench.
Mm-hmm.
The King's Bench was strictly by the law. If you felt that the law was completely against you, was wrong in your circumstances, you could then go to Chancery or equity to say it's not fair in this application.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in our Constitution, Article 3, they merged the two, and therefore you don't really have a rule of law because a judge, exactly as you say, you can say, well, here's the law. And the judge says, yeah, but I don't think it's fair.
You know, you used to have that in New Jersey, too. You had the Chancery Court, and you had the Equity Court, the law courts, rather. And that kind of got merged out of existence about 20, 30 years ago also. So getting on to economic things here, you're a proponent that there are these huge cycles of which most people aren't aware of, economists, whatever, that the business cycle is kind of alive and well, and that it kind of just takes its, it just does its thing, and there's nothing we can do about it. And you've made some amazing calls on markets based on your cycle theory. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I think what people have to realize is that there's one thing everybody does acknowledge is that there has been a business cycle. Mm-hmm. And, I mean, you can go back to the days of Rome, you still see rises and falls, and et cetera. You can't find a period where it's just a straight line. And what the emergence of communism was, and then the socialistic ideas that came out of the Depression, was that they were going to eliminate the cycle. So you take Marx, for example, what he basically proposed was taking away all property from the people, and therefore that would eliminate the cycle. But then what he failed to realize is that the corruption within government is still greedy, and he still ended up with the cycle.
That's universal. Nothing changes.
You can't get rid of it. Plus, part of the cycle is Mother Nature. Mm-hmm. For example, you know, the big earthquake in Japan has seriously impacted their economy. But most people don't realize is that the San Francisco earthquake of 1906 helped to precipitate the panic of 1907. Mm-hmm. And that set in motion the creation of the Federal Reserve. Mm-hmm. And it was largely because the insurance companies were on the East Coast and all the claims are on the West Coast.
Right.
So as the capital moved across the country, then there was a shortage of cash on the East Coast, and so banks in New York started to fail. Mm-hmm. And so that's why the Federal Reserve, and most people don't realize, but it was set up with these 12 branches, and each branch was independent.
Right.
So we actually had 12 separate interest rates. Mm-hmm. And the idea was that, okay, fine, if all the cash went to the Midwest because it was crop season and there's a shortage on the East Coast, then the East Coast could raise its rates by 2 points above that of the center of the country, and that would attract capital back that way.
Right.
And you know, there's been a lot of people talking about, you know, the Fed, it's really run by the banks and stuff like that. Well, the reason it was, and it was actually proper to do so initially, it was supposed to do what J.P. Morgan did. It was supposed to be the lender of last resort to the banks for a bank run.
Mm-hmm. Which happened kind of regularly back in those days.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And so what happened was you had, this was the system. And now, back then, when the Fed was going to stimulate or help the economy, it bought private paper, not government paper.
Right.
So it was buy corporate paper. Only because of World War One, then the politicians said, well, wait a minute, you should be buying our paper because we need to sell more. And then World War II, they basically ordered the Fed had to maintain all government bonds at par value. They didn't remove that until 1950. Mm-hmm. And then you see all of a sudden the bond market starts to decline. So the problem is that we also create these things. And the initial idea of the Fed was good. It was supposed to be a private entity. But then we keep saying, well, this happens. Well, we want you to do this, and then do this, and then do this. The next thing, I mean, this last crisis, now they can take over any company they think is too big to fail. It's not even remotely close anymore to what it was supposed to be.
Yeah, it was supposed to maintain full employment and price stability. and it seems like it's having a little bit of problem doing either of them at this point.
That's not what it was originally supposed to be.
Right. It wasn't social engineering project back then.
And the problem that you find when you go down the Capitol Hill is that a bunch of the majority of the people in Congress, when something happens, they just turn to the Fed and say, that's your job, fix it.
Yeah, they don't know anything about economics and they don't want to.
No, they don't. They really don't. And it's a shame, but they keep constantly adding more and more things to this stuff as you go. And then it's kind of like, you know, as you get older, if you pull out a picture of yourself from 20 years ago, you go, oh my God, what has changed?
I try not to do that. I don't want to see.
But it's the same thing. You know, you pull out a picture of where the Fed began in 1913, you go, what?
How did we get here? And that leads me to the next question. So maybe you do need some flexibility in the money supply, but you can't trust these guys because you're going to have this regulatory creep, this mission creep. Like, we go into a country and we're there to free the people, and the next thing we're there for 20 years nation building. So is there a place for a gold standard or some fixed money supply standard to stop this type of thing from happening? Because it's happened throughout history. It appears the only system I ever remember studying is in Byzantine, where their gold-backed system lasted 800 years, which is some kind of record. I don't know about Sumeria or Babylon, but 800 years it lasted just being based on gold. Can we possibly, in the modern era, devise such a system?
I don't think so anymore, largely because what we had back then was that the amount of gold that was around was at least increasing relatively close to the population increase.
Mm-hmm.
But today we don't really have that. The population tends to grow faster than we actually get new gold supplies. But that's not, we're looking more at a response rather than what is the real problem. And one of the things that I think that you can really, that your listeners can do, you can just go down to any bookstore and get the World Almanac, the current one, 2011, and it turns to about page 68 and has a national debt in there. And on a year-by-year basis, it's not the debt that I'm really concerned about. It breaks out how much has been paid in interest.
Right.
And what people don't realize, and I was telling them on the Hill just this week, I said, we can take what the Democrats say, and let's confiscate all the wealth, 100% from the rich. We'll pay off the national debt. The answer is no. Okay. So let's go to the Republican side. Let's get rid of all the social programs, get rid of all the freeloaders that they don't like. Will that solve the problem?
No.
The answer is still no. So what is the problem? And the problem is the fact that we borrow.
Right.
Now, what people don't realize is that if you look at that from 1986 to basically about 2006, the national debt increase that we have seen, about more than 80% of it is all accumulative interest.
Mm-hmm.
So we're not even getting social programs for this.
We're paying interest on interest effectively, right?
That's it. And 40% of it is exported out of the country.
Right.
Now, this becomes the problem that we have. You know, you can have QE1 through 200 if you want. Doesn't matter. you know, it sounds nice. The Fed can buy 30-year bonds and basically ease the long-term rates and put money back into the system. All these assumptions are basically from an antique. It's kind of like we were speaking Shakespeare, how far art thou? Because the economy has grown. It is a global economy today. China owns a tremendous amount of our debt, and that's why 40% of the money goes offshore. So if you're going to stand up and say, I'm going to buy 30-year bonds and I'm going to stimulate and put money into the economy to help it out, how do you know Americans don't use those 30-year bonds?
Right.
You know, if the Chinese sold them, which they did, then the money goes out of the country, goes straight to China, and it didn't do anything here.
Mm-hmm.
So all the tools and ideas of helping the economy and managing it and controlling it, they don't even work anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Most of those ideas are from the old gold standard. And they were from a period in time that, you know, capital wasn't as internationally inclined to run around the world as quickly as it does today.
Right.
But even in the 30s, part of the problem is that we particularly the academics, I think, have really seriously misled a lot of people. They tend not to have experience. So consequently, they look at theory.
Sure.
And rather than the reality of what's going on. And I think the problem began with Galbraith when he did his book on the Great Depression, and they focused on shine boys and stock, you know, and all that. He doesn't even mention the fact that in 1931 there was a sovereign debt crisis like we have today.
Yeah,
all of Europe defaulted, South America defaulted, China defaulted. I mean, you can go to an antique shop and probably we bought a lot of these nice bonds. They look very pretty, and we used to frame them up to always remind us what happened to government debt.
Yeah, well, government defaults are not unusual. So there obviously has to be a new system in place and a new way of allocating these resources that are limited, and it looks like a universal default or a grand jubilee is kind of inevitable, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think that I've been working on a book that I hope to have out sometime next year, but Adam Smith, in the last chapter of Wealth of Nations, he wrote about public debt, and he basically said he didn't understand why anybody called it quality, because no government had ever paid.
and that's the truth.
Now, he wrote this in 1776.
Mm-hmm.
But he doesn't give a list of all the defaults. So I decided, well, I'm going to maybe, flesh that out and start doing a book of all the historic defaults. Well, I'm up to about 1,000 pages and about 1,000 different defaults. And I am shocked at all the stuff that I have uncovered. I mean, the city of Mons is probably one of the most dramatic examples. Here was a city where Gutenberg, press was developed. It made a fortune. It was the center of printing. Politicians started taxing dramatically. They began to borrow against what they thought they would collect in taxes. So they chased the rich out of the city. Everybody left.
Right.
What was left was basically people who couldn't afford to pay the taxes. They ended up defaulting on their debt, like a lot of cities are doing today.
Sounds like New York City to me.
Or Harrisburg.
Yeah, Harrisburg, hundreds of cities around the country.
The interesting thing was that the creditors went into the city, looted it, and burned it to the ground. Pope then comes out and he excommunicated all the politicians for borrowing all this money with no intention of ever paying anything back.
The more things change, right? The more they stay the same.
And that's one of the most dramatic ones I found. But I mean, you go through it, you shake your head. You say, why do people ever buy government debt? Because they have never paid anything.
Yeah, because it's safe. It's guaranteed, right? And we're guaranteed, too. So.
Is that a gold standard? That's just not going to work, or anything else. We have a gold standard, and they still printed more money than we had gold.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, and that's what blew up in 71. So the only thing that I think that is really honestly going to stop it is you have to go back to the way it was, and that is that governments are not allowed to borrow, period.
Like
except
Nebraska,
in time of war.
Like the state of Nebraska, in their constitution, no debt. And that's,
you have to do that.
Yeah.
Because the temptation of a politician is vote for me and I'll give you XYZ.
Yeah.
And then you say, well, how are you going to pay for it? Well, I don't have to worry about it. That'd be 20 years down the road.
Yeah, and it has been. And now we're 20 years down the road and we're kind of screwed. So, Martin, tell us where we find you on the internet. We're definitely going to have you back on the Financial Survival Network again. It's really enlightening. You got a view of things that really not many people out there, and I've interviewed a lot, have.
Well, I actually go down to the Hill and I have worked with a lot of people around the world. You can find us on martinarmstrong.org or armstrongeconomics.com.
Great. Well, hey, thanks for being on, and we'll have you on again real soon.
Well, thank you for inviting me.